services, and more using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Club showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Online at cottonclubfutons.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump, every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the community forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion on Tuesday, March 26th at 7 p.m. at City Hall in Portland. The community forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion will address the realities of climate breakdown and the expansion of fossil fuels infrastructure. The event will pose questions about oil train traffic along the Columbia River, impacts on First Nations, and more. Again, that's the community forum on Zenith Tar Sands expansion on Tuesday, March 26th at 7 p.m. at City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Up next, Rising Up Sonali. If you're looking for The Struggle with Alyssa, it aired at 6 p.m. You can listen to a replay on the archive at kboo.fm.
KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Gohatkar. We'll spend the hour on our show today focusing on economic justice. First, a new book suggests that a feminist perspective is needed to change the demonization of the poor. Author Felicia Kornbluh will discuss her book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. Then Robert Friedman will delve into concrete examples and real-world solutions to deliver economic security with his book, A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. That's coming up in just a moment. Thank you. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A recent report by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities concluded that TANF, the government welfare program known as Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, is reaching fewer poor families. The number of poor Americans receiving assistance dipped to a low in 2014 and has remained there. The report concludes that TANF's work requirements and block grant structure exacerbate rather than reduce deep poverty. There was a time when the idea of welfare was not anathema in the U.S., but decades of demonizing the poor and blaming them for their plight has deeply skewed U.S. government policy, ensuring that there's always money for militarism and corporate subsidies or tax cuts for the rich, and never enough money for the most vulnerable Americans. Now, a new book suggests that a feminist perspective is needed to right this wrong. My guest is Felicia Kornbluh, Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. Her earlier book is The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics and Poverty in Modern America. And she's the co-author with Gwendolyn Mink of the new book. It's called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. Welcome to the program, Felicia.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this idea that welfare is a bad thing, that it is fostering dependence, which you often hear from members of the Republican Party, but even some Democrats, how far back does that go? I think of Clinton, who signed welfare reform, but really before him, it started with Reagan, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it's an old idea in America. You could go back even to, you know, when the African Americans who had been enslaved, you know, were emancipated in the Reconstruction period, and there's a lot of talk about people being lazy when in fact people are working incredibly hard. And then, right, the 20th century versions of this were really strong in the Reagan period. Reagan built his career in California when he was running for governor, talking about the so-called welfare queen. The woman who supposedly was receiving benefits she wasn't entitled to. And the really remarkable thing that we write about is how that idea found its way into the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And so even though we understand that conservatives are very much to blame for what's happened, we really want Democrats and progressives and feminists and liberals, you know, people who call themselves by those names, to take a good hard look at their politics and to be willing to rethink the politics of the 1990s.
So the idea of welfare is that the government, using the money of taxpayers, should be ensuring that the most vulnerable among us don't fall through the cracks, you know, are saved from starvation, but more than that, also given the help that they need in order to get back on their feet, or if they just need help for various reasons, get the help. But the idea of welfare has been linked to work. And so now we have this idea of welfare to work. Tell us what it was that Bill Clinton signed, the seminal bill, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act. I have to read it because I can't remember, it's so long, but it has all these buzzwords: personal responsibility, opportunity. These are Republican buzzwords. What did this act do in changing welfare in the U.S.?
Well, I consider this law kind of the original sin of the modern Democratic Party. And that's because we can really see a before and an after. Even though in the old days, you know, our anti-poverty programs were never perfect, women who are raising kids on the economic margins have never, you know, have never been sort of living high on the hog. But after 1996, what this law did was it said that even if a family, let's say a mom and her kid or two kids, even if they meet all the criteria, the federal criteria, the whatever eligibility standards their own state might implement, they're still not assured that they'll get assistance when they need it. At the national level, there is a maximum of 5 years that anybody could ever receive help over her whole lifetime. right? So if you have, let's say you have two kids and you're trying to get them into full day school, that 5 years isn't going to cover it. I mean, let's say you have the misfortune of being in an abusive relationship and you need to get out and you need some help. If you've already received benefits at some other point in your life, those benefits aren't going to be there that second time when you need the help. So it eliminated the so-called entitlement to aid. It's no longer an entitlement. It instituted instead this 5-year national time limit and allowed the states to have even lower time limits. It expressly allowed the states to institute what are called family caps, which we see as a real challenge to people's reproductive justice, allowing the states to not give any additional aid when you have an additional child. So effectively, you know, you lower the amount of money that somebody has for themselves and their family. And it instituted new controls on immigrants, even people with documentation. And this is a policy signed by the Democrats that said that if you are a legal documented immigrant, you cannot receive any of a whole range of benefits, not just this temporary assistance to needy families, but it also put in a bar for people who may need disability insurance or might need food stamps or what's called the SNAP program. So it really was a very, very much of a landmark piece of legislation, and landmark not in a good sense, in a negative sense.
And Bill Clinton signed it. He championed it. This is, you know, in so many ways, a big reason why people who are on the liberal side or left side of political spectrum just don't trust the establishment Democratic Party, because you've had Bill Clinton, you know, do stuff like this. Now, this particular bill and the welfare program in general is one that disproportionately impacts women, right? Hence this idea that you have these decisions being taken by a male-dominated government without thinking about how it impacts women. I'm thinking also sort of an analogy is how the reproductive justice movement is hampered by the fact that it's often men in positions of power making decisions. Is it the same? Is the same true for decision making and policy making on welfare, that we've had this anti-feminist, anti-woman ideology at the heart of all of this?
Well, I think so. And I would even go further and say, what it represents, it's not just the people involved, you know, but it's the substance of their decisions. And I think it really represents a misunderstanding of what's going on in American families and a misunderstanding of the work that many, many people do, but disproportionately women are the ones who are doing it. And I mean, you know, the work is the work of raising children, the work of, you know, reproducing our culture, reproducing our society, the work of caring for our elders, the work of making sure that when people are ill and disabled, that they have necessary support. Even the work of, you know, waiting in the doctor's office, waiting in the welfare office in order to get whatever resources are necessary for family survival. Like, that's work that has to be done, right? And it's disproportionately done by women, not just by women. And it's historically, it's a kind of work that has been associated with women or has been feminized. We call it, you know, caregiving or caretaking. And it's critically important to the survival of our society and our culture. And, you know, not only is it not recognized, but it seems like it's demeaned in our culture. And when we have a welfare policy that just makes it harder and harder and harder for people raising kids to survive, and that says, you know, we want you to work and we're not going to promise you childcare and we're not going to give you access to education and training and all those things. I think it's the most blatant kind of anti-feminism that we could imagine. And it's not just men who did it or have done it. But certainly men have been in the majority in the White House and in the Congress and so on.
And a lot of that has to do with how our economy is structured, right? With women who are expected to do all of the work of caregiving, including child rearing or taking care of the elderly, but not given the government support that they would need or they need to make that happen. They just have to figure out ways to do it all. And if you happen to be in the middle class or upper classes, you somehow manage, especially in the middle class. And if you fall anywhere lower, you can't manage no matter how hard you try. Is that what you mean when you say our current system is ensuring poverty, as the title of your book implies?
Yeah, that's exactly what we mean. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to look very far to find, you know, situations or times when even our culture, even our not very generous culture, did it better. Like in the big welfare program that was created right before the Bill Clinton era, there actually was a major welfare reform in the 80s that was a bipartisan thing. And there were a lot of problematic aspects of that, but there was one really good aspect, which is that the federal government said, okay, we want people to be in the labor market, but we're also gonna allow people to get education. And there actually was a big public investment in education programs. And you saw in community colleges all over the country, there were programs created for low-income moms who were going to be leaving the welfare rolls and who needed some, you know, some access to education and training. And the time that people spent getting educated was counted as work, which it is. It's a form of work. And that was eliminated in 1996. And people's access to work and training was really cut off and cut down to the bone, even while there was a lot of rhetoric about how we were going to be providing opportunity and promoting responsibility and it was going to be a contract and so on. It was, you know, kind of classic neoliberalism, a one-way contract imposed on the poor people, the people with less power in the situation. And there were no particularly enforceable aspects of that contract that people could bring up with the people who had political power.
How much of our current approach to welfare is also rooted in racist stereotyping? Do our policies disproportionately impact poor women of color?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is it's a great example of what academic and some other feminists call intersectional politics. And we try and kind of spell this out in the book, that you know, there is a feminist politics like of somebody like a Sheryl Sandberg, right, where she says all we have to do is lean in and, you know, assert our power and stuff like this. And for some, you know, wealthy white women, maybe that makes sense. Maybe that gets them somewhere. But what we're talking about is a politics in which women of color are disproportionately affected, and where the stereotypes that are really driving the bus in terms of public policy are at the same time racialized and gendered stereotypes. And the only way that we can really unpack that and I think get over it, recover from this stage of our politics, is to understand that and is to start to understand the world and take a view of the world from the perspective of low-income women of color who face a kind of unique set of challenges and circumstances and who have been right in the crosshairs of the worst kind of popular stereotyping. And Democrats as well as Republicans have been really, really complicit with that. And I think without our nation's racial legacy and without a particular kind of backlash against the civil rights movement and the women's movement, I don't think that we would be seeing these kinds of public policies.
We are entering an era where both the Democratic and Republican parties are being challenged from the grassroots by new and very inspiring newly elected members of Congress. The midterm election saw a wave of very outspoken women who were unexpectedly elected, at least unexpected for the establishment, who themselves have experienced poverty, who've been on government assistance programs, who've struggled to make ends meet and who are bringing this fresh perspective into government. Do you feel that that can help tilt government policy in the right direction and bring that desperately needed feminist perspective?
Well, I certainly hope so. I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful. The other day, I had the opportunity to talk with a former member of Congress, Representative Lynn Woolsey from California, and she is somebody who received public aid for herself and her kids when she needed it, and she brought that perspective when she was in Congress. So I do think that it changes your view, you know, if you have that history, and if you're honest about your history and you're true to your roots, the way it seems like, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York is, you know, really honest about her own roots. And
we had Deb Haaland from New Mexico, who's also someone who's spoken about her past. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's very promising. I think in terms of the Democratic Party, you know, a process started in 2016 during the primaries, and that process was kind of curtailed because then it was like all hands on deck to try and defeat Donald Trump. And then, of course, that didn't go so well. So I think there's an incomplete conversation. And now it's time to complete that conversation and to really say, hey, wait a minute, guys, like this is a party that went wildly off the track. In the middle 1990s, it went way too conservative. It gave too much away, and you know we see a little bit of that conversation around criminal justice reform. Thank God, this is another stage of that conversation that really needs to happen, and we haven't quite gotten there yet.
Do you find that those who continue to push this line about reducing government dependence feel that the current welfare program structure, as it is, has worked in any way? I mean, I cited at the beginning of our conversation this recent study from the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities showing that the program is reaching fewer poor people. Are some supporters of this program turning around and saying, look, that means that it works, instead of, sort of basically cherry picking statistics instead of actually examining it as a whole?
I think that's exactly what's happened. Mm-hmm. And to some degree continues to happen. One of the things that that I looked at a lot for this book, Ensuring Poverty, was the stream of reports that come out of those mainstream Washington, D.C. think tanks. And the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities tends to be very good, and I rely on them a lot for some of the basic numbers. But some of the others, like the Brookings Institution, which supposedly is a Democratic think tank, or the American Enterprise Institute, you know, I don't quite understand it. It just reads to me like propaganda or ideology. And they seem to think that they can build on the so-called consensus of the middle 1990s and the so-called success of welfare reform, you know, to move forward into new areas of social policy development. And I think it's completely insane and even murderous, you know, murderous or maybe genocidal if we think about particular communities that are being affected. But there is a lot of talk like that in Washington. There is not a lot of feminism in Washington. And the way I read it, there's not a lot of reality check, you know, about what they're saying. And they're looking so hard for common ground of a kind between the conservative wing of the Democratic Party and one portion or another of the Republican Party that I think it just, you know, it obscures the whole debate and distorts the whole debate. They won't get away with that anymore.
You just used two incredibly strong words, murderous and genocidal. Explain that a little bit more. How exactly do you make the case if you were speaking to a member of Congress who likes this idea of reducing dependency, fostering personal responsibility, all of these, individualistic, all of these buzzwords that have this idea rooted in American individualism? How would you explain to them that these policies are really genocidal? I mean, that's strong.
Yeah, well, it's sad. I think the data are pretty clear. We have good data from public health researchers, among others, that indicate that in states that implemented this welfare reform in a particularly draconian way, that we got more, what those states got was more death. People are dying earlier than they should if they're low-income moms with kids. And I guess it's not that surprising if you think about all the kinds of health indicators. Poor people in America are under incredible stress, and that psychological stress that causes mental illness, or even can be a species of mental illness. It's
physical stress. Suicide rates have gone up sharply.
Right. It causes suicide. It causes diabetes. It causes heart disease. It causes lack of sleep because people are working two jobs, and that becomes an additional health stressor.
Which stresses out children too, right? The children that are in these families.
Right. And, all of the studies that we know about trauma, losing a home is a trauma, being homeless is a trauma, experiencing physical violence or having your mom be a victim of violence, that's a trauma. And, when we really think about what's going on in the most impoverished families, like those situations are common. It's common to lose your housing. It's common to get into a relationship with somebody who's not that great and who may even be violent, because he has some resources that maybe you need and your kids need. The reason I call it genocidal is because I'm afraid that the only reason that some American politicians are willing to tolerate it is because they think it's happening to some other category of people, and they understand that category as a racialized category. I don't think they would tolerate it if they thought that these were, women like me, moms like me, or moms like my mom, moms like my spouse. I don't think it would be a tolerable situation to them.
But aren't white women also struggling and suffering who are among the poorest?
Yes, they are. They are. And one of the myths about welfare has always been that it was a majority black program or something. And that's never been true. But the problem is that the image drowns out the reality.
The welfare queen stereotype that Reagan promoted.
Right. It's racialized. It's propaganda. It's imagery. And that becomes a category that kind of a dumping category for people in Washington.
Well, Felicia, what do you think it's going to take to change these priorities? I mentioned there's always money for militarism. There's always money for, all sorts of things, tax cuts for the rich, which now we know that the tax reform bill that the Republicans passed is really stressing out state budgets as well. There's less money in the Treasury, which was their goal all along, right? To use that as a justification for cutting social spending and welfare programs. So they're just going right along with this train that they've started, but something's got to give.
Yeah, something's got to give. I learn a lot from friends of mine who are organizers, and what they say is, you don't create your campaign for the people who are just a no, right? And there are some people in America who, especially on this issue, on the issue of welfare and public support for moms and kids, they're just a no, a really hard no. So, okay, let's leave them alone for a while. I'm not going to worry too much about, people who are hardcore Trump voters, who are hardcore anti-welfare. But I think there are a lot of people who call themselves liberals or feminists or progressives who are not educated on this issue and who maybe are a little willfully uneducated about this issue because it's convenient to say that they're whatever, tough on poverty or tough on poor people. And so I think those are the people really to get and to apply pressure to. It might not be persuasion, it might be pressure instead, of the kind that some of the new members of Congress are willing to really enact. We could say, look, you don't get to be Speaker of the House if you don't take another look at this issue. You don't get to be a Democratic nominee. You don't get to be in a position of leadership if you're not willing to look at the mistakes that were made by the Democratic Party in the 1990s, and if you're not willing, to be good to your word about being a feminist. This is what it looks like to be a real feminist, not a BS feminist.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Felicia. Good luck with the book, and thanks for sharing your perspective on this critical issue.
Thank you.
My guest has been Felicia Kornbluh, Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. Her earlier book was called The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics and Poverty in Modern America. We've been discussing the new book that she's co-authored with Gwendolyn Mink. It's called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Although the stock market is booming, the majority of Americans continue to struggle financially today. A hand-to-mouth existence is sadly quite typical, and many families find building up a nest egg out of reach, let alone buying a home, saving up for their kids' college, or their own retirement. The struggles are even worse for people of color. But what if all it took was a few thousand dollars per person to deliver economic security to American families? Exploring this idea with concrete examples and real-world solutions is Robert Friedman, whose new book proposes a so-called prosperity bill. Robert Friedman is founder and chair emeritus of Prosperity Now. He helped create the U.S. microenterprise and savings and asset building fields and the international enterprise development and child savings fields. He now joins me to discuss his new book. It's called simply A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. Welcome to the program, Bob.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
So when you say prosperity, at first glance, if one isn't paying attention to the details of your book, it sounds like a word that Republicans like to use a lot, prosperity. And it's a word that unfortunately has come to mean in practical terms, wealth for the already wealthy. When you say prosperity for everyone, you, it sounds like in your book, really mean everyone, those among us Americans that are, you know, from working class all the way up to middle or upper middle class, right?
I really think that's the promise of America, something we've subscribed to in the ideal, unfortunately not in the reality, but I think we could make it part of our reality. I think everybody needs the ability to live in the future, not just in the past or in the present, to be able to shape a future for themselves. And I think they need a nest egg to do that. We have a thoroughgoing wealth building policy in this country. We spend on the order of what we're spending for defense on building up the wealth of families, but right now we're rewarding the rich, missing the middle, and penalizing the poor.
So the tax reform bill that was passed into law by the Republican Party at the end of Donald Trump's first year in office promised prosperity for everybody because it would withhold fewer taxes. But even that bill seems like is in line with existing government policy and would only worsen our current inequality and even be even greater inequality for people of color, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It did nothing, I think, to really invest in the American people. It was a product of, I think, this false thinking that it's the wealthy and corporations that are creating jobs, innovation, driving the economy. Really, I think if you look in our history, the kind of policies and investments that have driven significant, widely shared, long-term increases in economic well-being have been investments in the common genius, investments in common people. All net new jobs created in the economy over the last 30 years were created by new businesses. Those are not businesses started up just by wealthy people. They're started by people all over, all across the income spectrum. And I think you can find a lot of evidence that actually low-income people are more entrepreneurial than upper-income people, if only through necessity.
So let's talk about what it is that you propose in this prosperity bill. The first response from lawmakers to any proposal that involves, you know, helping ordinary people is, well, it would probably cost too much. It's going to cost too much. What does it cost? Where does the money come from? So explain what you mean by this prosperity bill.
Sure. So what you have to realize right now is we are spending in excess of $700 billion a year, that's with a B, on tax incentives for home, business, education, retirement savings, home mortgage interest deduction, preferential capital gains rates, pension fund exclusions, 529 college savings plans. But as we have designed them, they overwhelmingly reward the rich, miss the middle, penalize the poor. So the very richest 0.1% of American households, that is households making over $1 million a year, get an average annual benefit from those subsidies or incentives of $160,000. Whereas working families making under $55,000 get an average annual benefit of $226. That is $1 for every $800 the wealthiest get. This is obscene. The private sector and the private economy is doing very well at generating wealth inequality, which I think is more profound and larger than income inequality even. We don't need to subsidize that with the government. So essentially, my proposal is that instead of investing in people who don't need it, let's invest in everybody. And my organization, the nonprofit Prosperity Now, that I founded 40 years ago, and its many partners around our many partners around the country have proven that given even a few thousand dollars, low income, even very poor people will start businesses, buy and keep homes, go to college, create economic futures for themselves, their families, and the communities. If we simply invest in their savings and provide them incentives equivalent to what we're just funded out of what we're already spending, we could ensure that every American has the ability to amass a few thousand dollars a year to invest in their business, in a down payment on a home, in their dreams and talents and work.
Now, of course, those who are already wealthy know the power of being able to invest a few thousand dollars over many years, often taking advantage of programs that they find out about through the financial experts that they pay a lot of money to tell them about. But those who need that kind of wealth multiplication, if you will, the most often don't have that information and often don't have the means to even gather that small amount of capital to even start it. I'm really interested in the child savings field that you are a pioneer in. Every parent wants to leave their child better off than they were. And you point out in your book how just a few thousand dollars, and even the, you know, going from $5,000 to $10,000 makes a huge difference when you start out in childhood. Someone turning 18 has a much bigger start in life than they would have otherwise. Explain what the child savings idea is.
So the idea is that every kid should start with a nest egg. Of some amount of money. It's kind of hope in concrete form, if you will. Most kids do not have that today, and particularly kids of color. We found that a poor child with a college savings account in her own name is 3 times more likely to attend and 4 times more likely to finish than someone without, with even with less than $500 in the account. It's partly about finance, but it's also about expectations and psychology. If you think you're going to college, if your parents think you're going to college, you probably will. And so over the last 20 years, really, in this country and around the world, there has been a growing community practice, state policy, even federal policy around building child savings accounts. There are now 500,000 kids in 42 states and localities in the U.S. That have these programs. They start either at birth or in kindergarten. Cities like San Francisco, Oakland, states like Maine, Indiana have these programs. In Maine, Harold Alfond, who wasn't able to afford college, did very well with an insurance business, has provided in his estate that every kid born in Maine gets $500 at birth for a college savings account. This tends to be the way forward. We could fund this for every one of the 4 million kids born each year if we simply returned the estate tax to where it was in the early 2000s and make that federal subsidy for kids, really, available to all kids rather than just the kids that don't need it.
So the estate tax currently is essentially what used to be, that when a wealthy person passed away, before their inheritance made it to the people they left behind, it was taxed. And Republicans, conservatives, those who are more interested in seeing the wealthy get wealthier, pushed against that, called it a death tax, and have really cut away at the revenues that the government has access to. So today, you have wealthy Americans able to pass on much more of their inheritance when they pass away, leaving their descendants with a much greater leg up on life than their fellow Americans, right? So if we return things to the way they were, we could actually equalize the playing field a little bit.
We could not only equalize the playing field, but seed our future, right? I mean, the kids growing up today, a majority of whom will be kids of color, are our future. They're going to be taking the jobs, creating the firms, creating the jobs and innovations of the future. If they're not prepared, we will all suffer. You're right that critics on the right decry death taxes. I think who better to tax than the dead? You know, they don't complain. really, we only tax on estates, the very wealthiest estates. The tax bill last year raised the threshold for any tax on estates to $11 million, estates of $11 million for an individual or $22 million for a couple. Why should we be taxing earned income, labor income, which has been stagnating for 30 years, by the way, at a higher rate than we tax unearned income? And remember, the wealthy, and I would count myself among them, I was born lucky. Why should we pay less in tax, than someone who's working 2-3 jobs at minimum wage?
Right, because the descendants of a wealthy person have a much, much, much bigger advantage when they start out with money that has been inherited. So let's talk about the issue of home ownership. This is such a difficult issue for so many Americans. I'm here in California, and you are as well, where the housing market is so tilted toward those who are already wealthy. We have a shortage of housing. People are leaving the state because they can't afford to buy a home here anymore. And when the market crashes, you have hedge fund managers that swoop in, put cash down on houses, and then turn around and charge ever-increasing rents to those of us who continue to live here. How could the government, through a few simple mechanisms and policies, help ordinary Americans become homeowners by just investing a few thousand dollars?
Right. Well, let's just go back a little. First of all, homeownership is has been the centerpiece of the American dream. 89% of Americans across incomes, across racial groups, want to own their own homes, and for good reasons. I mean, homes are more than a house, right? They're the incubation, they're refuge, they're the place, the nest, where you develop dreams and skills, and families develop. We should be clear that the home ownership market is one that's designed by the government and created. It doesn't just descend on us. 120 years ago, only 10% of Americans owned their own homes because they had to come up with the full price of the home on day one. We created the 30-year mortgage. We passed the Homestead Acts, to which still 25% of the country can attribute its wealth. We can do it again and extend home ownership opportunity today because of those mechanisms, the 30-year fixed rate self-amortizing mortgage created by the federal government, and the housing finance giants like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other guarantees grew home ownership to about 2/3 of the American people, but in a very different racial profile. So 72.5% of whites owned their own homes, but only 43% of African Americans and 46% of Latinos. We have always done this with housing discrimination and redlining. But if we take the $251 billion a year that we're providing in federal tax home ownership subsidies, the most famous of which, but not the only of which, is the home mortgage interest deduction, which really doesn't help anyone buy a house. It's a reward for owning, really a reward for owing on a house. But if we took some of that $251 billion and instead said, we'll match your savings for a down payment on a home, we could enable all Americans to develop what is the key barrier to home ownership, which is down payments. There have been extensive demonstrations. We've done some with so-called individual development accounts, match savings accounts for home business education. The self-help in North Carolina did a big home ownership program for people making generally under $30,000 a year. 52,000 homeowners resulted from that experiment. We can create we can open up home ownership opportunity for Americans again if we just put our minds to it and deploy our substantial subsidies more rationally, more fairly, more productively.
What you're saying is that we already have all of this money that's that the government is pouring into it with all of these very specifically designed policies that simply aren't doing what they could be doing or are designed to not do and redesigning them would make an enormous difference. On a question that, you know, has perplexed so many of us, this is an election era issue often. We see potential presidential candidates understanding the importance of talking about reducing wealth inequality. But you have some, you've in effect written a guidebook, it seems. And now in your book, you also have a lot of examples, real world examples of how smaller scale programs of the kind that you discuss have actually benefited real people. Can you give us some of those examples? Because it really helps, I think, to hear a concrete story of somebody.
Sure. There's so many stories, and I do profile 24 in the book who, you know, I regard as economic heroes who, you know, have led led lives of the American ideal, you know, the rags to riches story. I think of David Greer in San Francisco, grew up here, tried to go to college. It didn't really work, went into the army, succumbed to heavy drinking habits, got out, ended up homeless for a while, literally living under the anchorage of the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge. Today, with the help of an individual development account, a match savings account, he owns not one but two homes in San Francisco, one of which produces income and the other is a home for his growing family. Mariana across the bay was an immigrant who again enrolled in an individual development account program where her savings were matched dollar for dollar, or actually I think 2-to-1. She never thought she could own her own home. She wasn't in a stable home until she was 9. She found out about the program, started doing research, found a home in Oakland, was able to buy it. Her timing was good. It was kind of post 2008. The rise in home equity enabled her to weather losing a job from an abusive employer. It allowed her later on to look around for a job for a while that was suitable. So, you know, the benefits of home ownership are myriad.
Overall, currently, Americans that are struggling financially, we have such a ripple effect through society, don't we? I mean, people stay in bad marriages for longer than they should because they don't have the economic independence. People who have tremendous amounts of college debt end up being unable to get out from under that cycle and don't have the freedom to follow their heart's passion because they're simply trying to pay off those burdensome loans and on and on. Doesn't that have a tremendous psychological impact on us as a whole?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, money is such a strange thing. It's a counter, really. You know, it's a way of counting, but it has tremendous psychological effects. I mean, if you're in debt, as most America, you know, as a third to a half or more of Americans are, you're not feeling very good about yourself. You're not looking ahead. You know, you're in stress, probably, you know, eventually a victim of post-traumatic stress syndrome, which lowers IQ and narrows bandwidth. I think that's why I think that everybody needs what I call future money, a nest egg for the future, a buffer against the everyday accidents and illnesses that otherwise become crises, but also an invitation to imagine a future better than the present, to plan for that future and prepare for that future when maybe only you believe, and ultimately the very American ability to invest in yourself and your kids. Again, we could create a system that allows that, and we have done that in the past. I think over the last 40 years, we have demonstrated child accounts, home accounts, business accounts, prosperity accounts, which are kind of all of those combined. We know the community practices that work. We know what's state and federal policies work. We know the kind of market adjustments that are necessary. There are literally hundreds of thousands of people who have benefited from these programs, and there are rigorously evaluated random assignment control group experiments that have been run. We know these things work. We know how to do it. It just remains for us to do it. We can also look to our history. I would say the greatest policies in our history, those that have created significant, widely shared, enduring economic well-being, have been investments in the common genius: universal public education, the Homestead Acts, the creation of the 30-year mortgage by the federal government. Perhaps the best example is the GI Bill. We don't think about the GI Bill a lot, but we said to our returning veterans from World War II, look, you defended the country. We will provide you low interest or no interest home loans, business loans, college loans. Those GIs, financed by that GI Bill, drove our post-war growth. In 10 years, they generated 220,000 businesses, 5 million new homeowners, 9 million new college students. They democratized college. Within 10 years, they tripled, you know, the GI Bill tripled the middle class changed the income distribution from a pyramid to a diamond. We could do it again. There was a dark side to the GI Bill, which, like those other human investments, basically was an investment in white men.
Right.
It never invested in the 17 million women who were the arsenal of democracy. It was deliberately left to state and local officials at that time operating under Jim Crow in the South to administer. As a result, African Americans in the South got very few of the GI Bill benefits to which they were entitled. I think we need a GI Bill for the 21st century, where the strengths of that bill outweigh the weaknesses. So for everybody, for home, for business, for education, for other high return human investments, citizenship, assistive technology, designed in such a way that it closes the racial wealth divide rather than exacerbates it. And I just should note for your listeners, African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, many Asian Americans have a few cents for every dollar whites have. This is a product of our history, and it is an incredible penalty starting from birth. You show me, tell me the assets of a family and with the birth of a child, and I can pretty well predict to you there that child's educational, health, occupational, income status 50 years in the future. This is not the meritocratic society we want to be. I would also argue, based on our experience, that by investing in everybody, the whole everybody will benefit. You know, the educational benefits of the GI Bill alone, the return on investment was $7 to $1 just for the educational benefits. We would grow the whole economy if we allow people to move ahead. And, you know, but there's a need for more than just wage-based income. Wages have been stagnating while expenses have been going up and volatility has been increasing. We need to reinvest in the American people. We need to bring people back into the marketplace and into the quest for a better future for all of us.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Bob. Thank you so much, and good luck with the book.
I really appreciate this opportunity.
My guest has been Robert Friedman, founder and chair emeritus of Prosperity Now. He helped to create the U.S. micro enterprise and savings and asset building fields and the international enterprise development and child savings fields. We've been discussing his new book, A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Bus is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.